Good to be with you on ABC Radio around Australia this evening and on your pod. This first hour, we're going to talk about science and religion. Well, the alleged conflict that appeared between those two notions within our modern world. But before we get to our august panel, there has been a development in Victoria, of all places. As you probably know, our nation was founded after the Enlightenment, unlike America, unlike European nations. And even our very first university, Sydney University, was founded without a theology faculty. Well, despite that, religion classes have been taught in our free, secular and universal state schools pretty much since they were established. And in the 19th century, it was even 1 hour a day in state schools. Well, fast forward to 2015, and until this year, pretty much all religious groups can offer these SRE, which is Special Religious Education, or SRI, Special Religious Instruction classes, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Buddhist, Baha'i, Muslim, and so on, depending on who's in the school and if the teachers can be fielded. But the half-hour dedicated weekly Special Religious Instruction period is about to end in Victoria after a decision by the Andrews government. Other states and territories will no doubt be looking at the Victorian decision, an historic one given the history of this nation. In quite a few states, it's part of the Education Act that this subject be included in the school curriculum, like it seems the ACT, Queensland, South Australia and Victoria until next year. There's been a lot of to and fro about this, but joining us to talk about his own reaction to this is the Primate of the Anglican Church of Australia, the Archbishop of Melbourne, Philip Freer. Archbishop, can I ask you, how have the consultations gone between you and the government on this to come to this point?
Good evening, Noel. Well, I think the consultations have been non-existent pretty much in every direction. So I think, from what I can gather, almost everyone was surprised by this announcement on Friday. And I'm yet to understand the extent to which many aspects of it have been thought through.
At this point, it seems the announcement is that the scheduled half hour, which has been within the school day, is to be moved to a 30-minute program over either lunchtime or after school. That's not likely to be popular with students, is it?
Well, the whole arrangement really goes back. It's a long-standing one, and I suppose it's remarkable enough that it's existed, but churches in Victoria, in a way, closed down their primary schooling in the 19th century so they could better support the effort of state schooling. And one of the agreements was that there would be the opportunity for religious adherents to be instructed in their faith by ministers and other members of their community. And so we've had this this arrangement enduring for over 100 years, and in Victoria, the churches got together and formed an entity to do that ecumenically. And I think the way it has been done, where it's happened in class time, is unlikely to be able to just be shoved off to out of school hours or a lunchtime break. It might mean there's got to be an entirely different understanding of how those things will happen, because it's unlikely even the most enthusiastic students are going to be wanting to line up for another half an hour of extra work during their lunch break.
You used the word adherence, and certainly it was the case in the very earliest part of the colony in Australia that priests and nuns, also Catholic nuns, were on the government payroll, certainly until 1836 with the Church Act in New South Wales. And there's been a lot of toing and froing over two centuries about what the role of that would be in the classroom, whether it's to teach how to be a Christian or whether it was to teach values. Now, the Fearist group, which is a group which is strongly opposed to religious education in these half-hour slots, says that Access Ministries does about 96% of special religious instruction in Victoria and that its CEO says that they're to make disciples. Now, my question is, in your mind, as primate, as archbishop, as a religious leader, should families in state schools have access to classes in their chosen faith tradition, or should it be done outside in the secular system, as Fearis is saying, really?
Well, I think faith formation is going to happen in many contexts, and certainly there would probably be very limited results if we were relying only on opportunities in government schools. But it's interesting, in Victoria, the arrangements have gone from an opt-out model to an opt-in model. So According to the press release on Friday, about 20% of the students in Victoria are opted in for SRI, special religious instruction, from a variety of people, including Christian and non-Christian groups. The Christian groups, which cooperate together under Access Ministries, as you've described, are the biggest, by far the biggest component. But it's an opt-in arrangement, and so there's no compulsion, and I think the intention is that it will be explicitly about an education in Christian faith, and that's the intention of the parents who opt into it. So the changes in Victoria have been very rapid, moving from this kind of opt-out model where generally things were available for class groups as a whole, as they sought, and now an opt-in model by about the parents of about 20% of the primary school children. And that a very quick change, and in a way, a very rapid exiling of this particular and long-standing aspect of tolerance in the school curriculum out of school hours.
The Victorian Opposition Education spokesman Nick Wakeling said this decision by the Andrews government is an ideological whim. He uses that word. But given that state schools don't generally have qualified teachers in this area, people with theology or with scripture qualification, and the system itself, the institutional system, doesn't actually have the ability to assess the quality of teaching, is this, in one sense, a foreseeable step that secular forces would say, look, we don't want this here, it's not professional teaching?
Look, there's a range of arguments that could be made that way, but I think there's... This announcement on Friday was part of, it was something slipped into a much different headline. It was a headline about developing a curriculum yet to be developed that's going to build healthy relationships, understanding global cultures, ethics and traditions, and the prevention of family violence. So a very important and big catch-all of a lot of things that are well worth doing for any students in primary schools. And I understand the Victorian Curriculum and Assessment Authority has been tasked to develop some resources for teachers in that area. And it's interesting in the quotes that the Minister for Education and the Minister for the Prevention of Family Violence have offered in that press release, those things are highlighted. And so it's just really, in a sense, at the side of it, a little bit of time for those 20% of the students who are opted into SRI will be freed up. But there's certainly schools, there's whole schools, whole primary schools in Victoria that don't teach any SRI at all. The principals had been given some latitude in recent years not to open their schools to SRI, and the whole system seems to have been following that line. So I think there's many questions as to how these important and welcome developments in primary education are going to be fitting in, what other things are going to give away in the normal curriculum. So I think that the SRI announcement, whilst being very significant, is amongst a bit of a grab bag of ideas that's probably happened without consultation with many people at all.
Archbishop, just to finish, you've mentioned that you certainly had not been directly consulted with over this change. I would imagine that's probably likely for your fellow Archbishop, the Roman Catholic Archbishop, and for other leaders, but I'm sure you'll be finding out if they have been consulted. What will the next step be for you, do you think?
Well, I think from some of the press that's just developed over the weekend, I think there's been very little consultation all around. But I think that the first response is, if this is now the fact, when that comes into effect, how we might develop appropriate resources that might be constructive for students during lunch breaks or before and after school. I mean, I think there is still opportunity for engagement. I mean, one of the great riches, I think, of this is it really is... SRI has been an engagement of local people in local communities with their local schools. If you take out some of the other kinds of things that you've named, there's a really important thing about the relationship of community to school. And certainly, as I speak from the Christian churches, volunteers who are well connected with their community, and I think that's a great thing. It's a great thing for schools to be interacting with their communities, for children to be interacting with people of different generations, and that would be a very sad thing if that's lost out of these changes that have been announced on Friday.
Archbishop Philip Freer, Archbishop of Melbourne and Primate of the Anglican Church of Australia, thanks for being part of Sunday Nights.
Thank you, Noel. Always good to speak with you.
You're on Sunday Nights with Noel Debien.
Well, it's certainly an interesting development, that announcement. And it's one that in Australia, of course, has been under discussion probably since our foundation. It's another step in the place of religion in our society and how it should fit in our officially secular society. And if you think about it, that issue is sort of connected to what we want to discuss in this hour, because the whole issue between science and religion has been also a long-standing debate, and it's about how valid are these ideas, how should they be represented socially, even in our schools. And as you probably know, science originally simply meant knowledge. That's all it meant. But the modern meaning really has shifted now, so that in 2015 it really does refer to one specific type of knowledge, scientific and empirical thought. Before the Renaissance, though, for us, our Western thinkers all agreed that theology was a science, believe it or not. It was the so-called queen of sciences. And in fact, what we call science today was a sort of a minor subject of the whole study of theology. Well, things have turned around. Since universities were founded specifically to study theology, starting in Bologna, zip forward to Sydney University, it was founded without a theology faculty. And in that Renaissance, a funny thing also happened, because here in the West we rediscovered a lot of our lost scientific heritage. It had gone missing in war and disturbance. There were Muslim and Byzantine scholars who restored Greek philosophy and scientists to us in Arabic and Greek. You may have heard of them, Muslim scholars including Al-Farabi, Ibn Rushd of Veroes, we Latinize it as an Avicenna, Ibn Sina, gave us back piles of previously lost natural science and philosophy. That's what created our Renaissance here. Fast forward again to 2015, it seems all too often in public discussion, the assumption is that science and religion are simply opposed to each other and, well, mutually exclusive. Flat Earth, seven-day creation, natural law, the persecution of Galileo, you've heard it all. But this year, just for a bit of confusion, we've seen a pope, together with an ecumenical patriarch in Constantinople, position themselves to take the lead on climate change, of all things, with Laudato Si. Well, that's while climate change deniers are attacking actual scientific method. Isn't it a mess? What are we going to do? Well, in this hour, to talk about some of these things, we have a dazzling collection for you. From Jordan is Dr. Rana Dajani. Now, Rana is a member of the Muslim Science Comms Task Force on Science and Islam. She's a molecular biologist. She's an associate professor at the Hashemite University in Jordan. She's also been an Eisenhower Fellow, a Fulbrighter twice, and she's a visiting professor at the Yale Stem Cell Centre and University of Cambridge. Rana, thank you very much for joining us from Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
Now, also here in studio with me is Dr. John Carmody. Now, John is a retired professor of medicine, 40 years a medical scientist at the University of New South Wales. He also happens to be president of the Catholic Historical Society, so he's got two mitres on tonight. John, thank you for joining us.
To cover my bald spots now.
And then in Bellingen, joining us from the radio studio, the local radio studio there, is Dr. Jason John. He's a Uniting Church minister who works with the Uniting Church's Earth Ministry, the Uniting Earth Ministry. He happens to be a Tabitha Grant recipient, and that was to extend his exploration of the interplay between evolution and theology. Jason John, welcome to the program. And then also in our Melbourne studio, Jonathan Meddings. Now, he's a board member of the Rationalist Society of Australia. Jonathan, welcome, and I hope you keep us grounded.
My pleasure.
And we also have Michael Brown, an associate professor and an astronomer at Monash University, who specialises in the evolution of galaxies over billions of years. Now, there's something to study. Welcome to the program, Michael.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Rana Dajani, can I start with you in exotic Jordan? Because mm-hmm. I'd like to begin with evolution, of all things. It's often used as an example of contradiction between religion and science. You're a scientist, you're a Muslim. How much is Darwinian theory at the heart of the conflict that's perceived so often, do you think?
I think that the controversy between evolution, Darwinian evolution, and religion, and in particular Islam, is actually a myth. And it really doesn't exist. And if one looks at the history of the apparent conflict, it really did not exist in the Muslim world. It more existed maybe in the Western world or in the Christian world. And I will not speak about the Christian world since we have all these experts on the panel. I'll just speak from my side, from the Muslim perspective. So if we look back in the Islamic civilization that you mentioned earlier, there were scientists who had discussed theories that relate to Darwinian theory of evolution, speaking of ancestors for the prevailing species at that time.
This is before Darwin, you mean? This is actually before
Darwin. This is like one of the scholars called Al-Jahiz around 1400 years ago, who actually had mention of humans coming from earlier ancestors, from simpler forms. And he and others along the centuries that discussed these issues were never persecuted, and there was no controversy between what they proposed and what they discussed from a scientific, purely scientific point of view, and religion and theology. Islam is about pursuing the truth, seeking scientific facts, trying to understand the world, the natural world around us, and it has nothing to do with how we carry on our daily lives. Fast forward, even after Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species, although we had less natural scientists around, but there were a few who actually understood what Darwin was talking about and agreed with him, like a scholar called Al-Jisr in Lebanon in the late 19th century. And he wrote a whole treatise where he supported what Darwin proposed.
Yes,
absolutely. And then, so the conflict that came to the Muslim world came from two ways. One, the Christian conflict itself around Darwin did not go unnoticed by the Muslim scholars in the Muslim world. They noticed that there's this conflict. Some people, some Christian sects supported him and some weren't, didn't. The other point is that at some point, this was the epitome of colonialism around the world, and many of the colonialism thought was perceived as social Darwinianism. And so there was a mix from the people or the nations that were colonized between the colonizer and social Darwinism. So if you supported Darwin in a way, you were supporting colonialism, and so the two got mixed up in a way. And because of lack of natural scientists at that point, because of colonialism and dictatorships, we didn't have enough natural scientists to actually explore Darwin and see that there was no conflict, this apparent myth came to be.
And in fact, now I think, Rana, you are leading the charge. You're one of the leading Muslim intellectuals talking about this. But can I ask you, before I move to Jason John, Rana, can I ask you, do you have this same issue, though? Because there are groups of Christians who believe in seven-day creation. Do you find groups of Muslims who want to tell you that it's a seven-day creation? Is it similar?
No, actually, it isn't similar. And like I said, the Quran, as we consider it, it's not a scientific book, meaning we don't look for evidence for scientific facts around us in the natural world. We look at the Quran as a guide on how to conduct our lives with other human beings, how to take care of our environment, and how to pursue and seek the truth. So in the Quran, it talks about the scientific method, meaning to observe, to come up with hypotheses, and to test them. But it doesn't actually set forth the facts. And the reason is because science changes, and these facts may change according to the advancement of the tools we're using or the facts that we're discovering. Therefore, religion is just how to live our lives, and so there's no conflict. There's no 7 day that everything was finished at 7 days, or that Adam was created in a literally sense. Mm. And if on the surface there appears to be a contradiction between, say, a verse in the Quran and the scientific fact, we say that we must check the science first, because science keeps changing, and then we check the interpretation of the verses, because the interpretation of the verses is human, and humans err, and that can change from generation to generation, according to the changes in the circumstances and the knowledge around us.
Well, that's a very interesting opening, Sally. I've already learned quite a bit. Dr. Jason John, can I bring you in here? Because it's sounding like Christianity has more of an issue with this in its sects, doesn't it?
I have met Muslims that probably would prioritise their interpretation of the scriptures over the science, but but it's certainly a big deal in Christianity, more so in America, but Australia has some significant pockets of creationism. I think, you know, probably over 50% of Christians would say that they understand that creation happened in the way described in Genesis.
50%, did you say?
Yeah, a little bit over, I think.
Wow, I wasn't aware of that figure.
Some would then say that they think that ought to be compatible with evolution as well. I think it's about 30% that would say evolution is wrong and Genesis describes the way life was created.
Well, Jonathan Meddings, can I bring you in here? You're a member of the Rational Society. How do you respond to what you've heard so far from Islam and Christianity, just as an opening, Sally?
Well, I'm not too familiar with Islam and creationism, but speaking to Christianity and creationism, I think that certainly there is a conflict between science and religion as far as that's concerned. And it's not just, by the way, evolution and creationism. We see conflict all the time, whether it be opposition to life-saving stem cell research because a clump of cells is believed to have a soul.
That'd be a particularly Catholic position, I think, but I think there'd be conservative. You might have something to say on that, John Carmody. That's a reference to, I think, the use of embryonic cells, isn't it?
I would think so. That's becoming less and less of an issue, not because necessarily the philosophy or the theology is being resolved, but that people are discovering ways of turning other cells back into their so-called stem cell pluripotential form so that they can, as happens in the fertilised embryo, the whole biochemistry is very fascinating about what it is that makes a cell, a liver cell or a heart cell or a muscle
cell. Other forms.
And presumably that's a chemical thing because all the DNA is still there. Some of it's just not being expressed. And so the aim has been to say, well, okay, if we can get cells from liver or muscle which are innocuous theologically and we can somehow re-engineer that biochemistry back to what it was again, then we make it pluripotent. That is to say, could develop into any other form of cell.
Now, Jonathan, it's interesting you bring up, because there are so many issues where this conflict happens and the use of embryonic stem cell is just one, but can we stick to evolution for the moment?
Sure.
That's okay.
Well, I actually have a question for Jason. I'd like to know how he reconciles his belief in evolution with a belief in a loving God.
Jason, perhaps you could take that.
I don't see a conflict between our evolutionary origins and a loving God. A big problem for Christians often has been the idea that creation was created perfect, and that is without pain and death. And therefore had to explain how a good God, how we could believe in a good God given that the creation involves pain and suffering and so on, which led to the Adam and Eve story. But I guess I see that pain and death are, and therefore, to me, I don't understand the contradiction between the idea of a God of love.
Well, perhaps I could elaborate a bit on what I perceive to be the contradiction.
Sure.
It was an argument put forward by Christopher Hitchens, and I continue to put it forward in his absence. I mean, here's what you have to believe if you believe in evolution and also believe in God. You have to believe in a God who has implemented a system whereby living organisms wage constant battle with each other, killing and eating each other.
Why is that a problem? Why is that? Why are you making a theological issue about that?
That's a Catholic talking to you there, I think, and a scientist.
What's wrong with killing and eating each other? Well, I'm a vegetarian, but...
you kill and eat plants. I mean, they're living forms. That's not the issue. I mean, I don't see... I mean, for example, there are people born with failure development of the part of the nervous system which, when it reaches the brain, will be perceived as pain. Many people, I think, wouldn't it be wonderful to be without pain? In point of fact, they lead appalling lives and subject themselves to all sorts of damage. So the notion that somehow or other pain or predation is incompatible with any kind of civilised life seems to me to be biologically naive at the very best.
So John Carmody, are you saying there that you're quite happy to accept evolution as a theory, being that, and you're also Christian?
Well... It was a gargantuan intellectual proposal based on evidence which Darwin had been able to collect, and it was an enormous intellectual leap. The ripples in the pond of that stone being cast into scientific and general intellectual life are still going on. But to collect evidence, which is what science is ultimately all about, is a lifetime's task for many scientists, but it's many lifetimes' task for Darwinism. Just because people can't see that every little bit of evidence is put into place doesn't mean to say that the intellectual notion doesn't have some validity. If we go back to Karl Popper, for example, it was about falsification. It's you can't prove anything to be true in one scientific sense, but you can certainly prove things to be untrue.
Be false, yeah.
And nobody has yet been able to falsify evolution. The task of putting more and more stones into place into that puzzle is centuries old.
Now, Rano, have I got you there? Does that sound like an argument you'd be having among Muslim scholars?
No, the reconciling a loving God with evolution, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. No. Actually, not. Because the way we look at things as Muslims is that God has a greater plan that we may not be aware of the minor details of at the moment. And our life's objective is actually seeking the truth and trying to understand it. But we may not within our lifetime or even the lifetime of humankind. And it's all part of the greater plan. It's similar to the entropy theory, where if you look at a closed system, it doesn't make sense. But then, when things are not going towards entropy, there's more order, for example. But if you look at the zoom out and look at the bigger picture, you can see the entropy happening, and it makes sense. And I think we are focusing and looking in a very small area of the universe, or of knowledge, or of science, when we say it appears not to, we cannot reconcile a loving God with evolution. But if we zoom out, which we may never biologically be able to actually, to understand the bigger picture, where it all makes sense, even the fighting and the conflicts and all that.
Michael Brown, that's probably registering with you. You do the big picture, don't you?
13.5 billion years, yes. That is reasonably big picture.
Are you being persuaded?
No dispute there, Michael.
Because you sort of sit in the middle, don't you, on this? You'd consider yourself a scientist, not a religious person as such, but you're open to both, as I understand it.
Well, I'm not a religious person, but I don't see necessarily that there is a conflict between religion and science. And indeed, there's many scientists, obviously, some who have been mentioned already. There are many religious scientists, and their daily work does not interfere with their science, and their daily work doesn't interfere with their religion. And the sort of exemplar of this is the Jesuit astronomers who use the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope, which is better known to astronomers as the Pope Scope. There are many scientists who work very productive lives, do excellent science, and it doesn't conflict with their...
Well, there's also Rana Dajani, of course.
Yeah, well, exactly. That said, and they have been mentioned already, that there are cases where you do find people where their very particular interpretations of religious texts do directly conflict with science. And the classic example of that might be young Earth creationists, who do have a few issues with the Big Bang and the universe being over 13 billion years old. And there you do see occasionally some scientists who I would say stray into pseudoscience because they're trying to bend observations, theory to try and suit their...
to fit into scriptures, as it were.
Beliefs. Yeah, exactly, their particular interpretation of it. Now, it should be said for, say... the Catholic Church has accepted that the Big Bang, and indeed it was a Catholic priest who was one of the developers of the Big Bang theory.
Indeed it was.
So it depends on one's religious views.
Michael, it seems to me that ultimately perhaps we should have started with this sooner. It's ultimately a question of what people conceive each of those two activities is. To me as a scientist, and I don't know what you think as an astronomer working on a different timescale, but to me science is about our best efforts, and it's a continuing process, our best efforts to understand the operations of the natural world, the biological and the physical world in which we live, and to do that by the most scrupulous observation that we're capable of and the most rigorous analysis of that observation. Religion is more about how people then choose to live their lives within those physical and biological worlds, and it's no more contrary to science, or ought to be no more contrary to science, than the practice of music or art, or literature or poetry, all of which are also about trying to find ways in which we can live our warm human lives within that world. But they're two very different activities.
I'd say the ought is a very important word there, and I think it depends on the views of the particular person. So I think perhaps with the people involved in the panel this evening, it's not a particular problem, but mm-hmm. you can certainly identify people out there, including some scientists, where their theological beliefs or their ideological beliefs impact how they work on science. So, for example, there's a physicist who I'm aware of in Australia who does particularly good work on precision clocks and frequency standards, but he's also a young Earth creationist and dabbles in cosmology. And his dabblings in cosmology, which have some currency in the sort of young Earth creationist movement, are frankly amateurish and have the sort of pseudoscientific trays of selective use of evidence, selective use of the literature, and sort of basic errors because he's dabbling well outside of his own expertise.
Life is complicated, though. You've got to admit that people are not always consistent, are we?
And as Rana said absolutely. Wonderfully, perceptively a few moments ago, the Quran, and one might equally say the Bible, is not a scientific textbook.
Exactly. But I think that's an ought. So I think certainly the people on this panel are interpreting it that way. But there's certainly religious sure. people out there who do. Interpreted in a very much more, it's said, literal way, but maybe others will disagree with
that. Well, let's go to just that. I've got a list of things that I'm trying to cover here because I could think of five rough things that, you know, you really need to address if you're talking about science and religion. We've talked a little bit about evolution and creation, but what about the role of literalism and fundamentalism, you see? I think, Rana, you've already answered this in terms of the Quran as you see it.
Yes, absolutely. That we shouldn't take it literally. We should, and our explanation should be depends on the circumstances and the rate or the level of knowledge at that time. And we shouldn't make it our objective to find the scientific facts in the Quran. However, I think I would like to agree with one of the panelists that there's two separate things. It's how I conduct my life, and that's where religion comes along. But it also, religion helps us put the guidelines and the ethics when dealing with scientific issues. And in this circumstances, it's important for not one person to interpret the guidelines for setting the ethics of pursuing science. It should be a committee of people, scholars from different fields, language, theology, science, physicians, depending on the topic, until they come up with whatever interpretation that fits the circumstances. And that in itself is not set in stone and should be addressed as science advances all the time.
Jason, John, can I bring you in here? Because you're actually writing a book with a section on your personal religious journey. Once an agnostic stroke atheist, then a literalist Christian, then an evolutionist Christian, and now you're doing a biocentric scientific Christian story of creation. Now, it seems like you've been through a few stages there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was around my 20s when I became a Christian, and having just graduated from science, very much approached the Bible as a textbook of what I needed to know to be a Christian.
A science textbook chapter. As well, you mean?
Yeah, basically, like probably without thinking about it consciously, but that typical argument of, well, if the first bit's wrong, how am I going to know that the last bit's right? And so yeah, I had a very literalist approach there for a while, which was interesting because I was still tutoring biology at Adelaide University at the time.
Another sleeper from the sounds of it.
Yeah. But then, had some time, took a month over the holidays to sit down in the library and look at the creationist textbooks that I had and the references they were making to the scientific journals in the library and came to the conclusion over that time that either they were just inaccurately, whether through deliberate misinterpretation or accidental misinterpretation, were just getting a lot of the science wrong, and that, I guess, led to my journey back. But more particularly was meeting theology students who didn't take the Bible literally, because I didn't even know you could do that, really. And their reason for rejecting a six-day creation was actually the biblical texts themselves, nothing to do with science, like Genesis 1 and 2 have different orders of creation, for example. I just wanted to make one quick point before we...
That's another issue that I want to get to, of course, because if you go to one of those orders of creation, the woman gets taken out of the man's rib, and she is clearly his helpmate.
Yep.
And in another order of that same creation in Genesis, the man and the woman are male and female. He created them. So depending which bit of Genesis you read, you can either theorize that women are subject to men, or you can theorize that men and women are created equally. And that brings me to the third issue I wanted to talk about, which is, of course, the role of men and women and how religion is used in that on the basis of anthropology or religion. You know, how do you look at it? Now, can I go to you, Rana, for a moment on that? And the place of women, of course, is constantly debated in Islam as it is in Christianity, whether women should be leaders, whether should be priests, all that sort of stuff. In terms of science and the Quran, how do you reckon they compare in the place of men and women and their roles?
So in Islam, men and women are created equal. They're both humans in the eye of God, and there's no difference. They both have their equal rights, and what are the basic human needs in terms of education, right to survive, right to everything which is basic. Their roles may differ according to their biology, because evolutionary, they are different. And because of that, their roles and responsibilities may differ. And so in that sense, they complement each other in fulfilling those roles. However, in terms of human rights, they're equal. And in the Quran, in the creation of Adam and Eve, so to speak, there's no preference where Eve came from Adam or vice versa. They were equal. Even the story of Adam and Eve, and that the one in the Christian Bible, in Islam, it is Adam who made the mistake and Eve had nothing to do with it. So she is not...
Oh, no, well, there's one for the books. I think more Christians might like to hear that version of the story.
So females and males are actually equal in that sense. And as you know, I'm sure from history, that in Islam, women were given their rights a long time before when Islam came. However, what you see today in modern society is not the real religion. It is after people have left the Islam, and you have tribalism and local culture that has crept in and smeared what Islam is, and so misrepresents it in the media. And that's why we have the stereotype of the Muslim woman, which is not the real Islam.
Now, Jonathan Meddings, can I bring you in there? Because, of course, I hear Rana arguing for a perfect form of religion. Christians would like to argue that religion can be perfected. We just haven't tried it properly, you know what I mean? How do you respond to that?
Well, I want to jump back a little bit, because we've heard a couple of speakers put forward this notion generally that science and religion are separate and non-overlapping magisteria. You hear this a lot. You have people who argue that science and religion aren't in conflict because they deal with different things. These people say that science deals with matters of fact and religion deals with morality and values. But religion deals with matters of fact all the time, the existence of God, his intervention in human affairs, God creating life, people having souls. These are all statements of fact, even though many like myself believe them to be fiction.
Look, I see what...
I had to jump back because I didn't get a word in edgewise before.
Oh, no, go for your
but
life.
To your to your more recent question about women in Islam, look, anyone who's read the work of Ayaan Hirsi Ali knows that women are not treated equally in Islam today. And I don't think any reading of Islamic texts can support that assertion.
Oh, well, Rana, you've got absolutely the right to reply there, because I look around at Christianity and I'm finding it a bit hard to understand that they're treated equally too. But Rana?
Because I'm on the radio, I can't understand who's speaking what. But what was just spoken now, if we go back to the text, the Quran, taking out all the culture and tradition, men and women are equal. It is the misinterpretation along the centuries because of culture, because of misunderstanding, where we have the mistreatment of women. But for example, if you go into the Quran now and read, it says women, for example, they have equal rights to men. And when they are married, they do not even have to take care of their house or their children or their husband. They only take care of themselves, and they have total freedom. And in the Quran, it says the husband is obliged to provide for her, for the house, for the children. Even he has to pay her money to breastfeed her children if she doesn't want to. So she has the total freedom in terms of her own money, her own education. This is what's in the text. Now, what people do is different and is wrong, but we should not blame the religion on the people. We should work for re-understanding the right religion and giving freedom to question and to change to what is better and what is right.
Now, we're going to run out of time because I know we're trying to solve the entire problem of theology, which is an entire understanding of the world and cosmos, of course, at the moment. But there are two other issues I'd really like to touch on. Now, one is the climate change issue, and the reason I'd like to touch on that is because that is where actual scientific method itself is being attacked, or science itself is being attacked for political reasons, you could argue, or for other reasons. I don't know. I can't answer for them all. And that's a complex area, I think. Perhaps I could start with Jason John. Like, the Pope has taken a strong approach on climate change, so has the Ecumenical Patriarch, so has the Uniting Church, many churches. It seems to be a bit of a game changer. What do you think this means for the science-religion alleged rift?
Okay. First, let me say I agree completely with what Jonathan was saying about the separate magisterium. Like, they're not, religion makes truth claims which science has turned on their head.
Yep.
And we need to deal with that. And climate change, I think, is one of them. Because there's a fairly strong theological current in some churches that says that God is in total control of the world and that nothing can happen unless God wills it to happen. And that's the Pope re-emphasises that in Laudato Si. So you end up with this very strange dichotomy between the Pope's strong call for action on climate change and yet saying that ultimately there is no evil that can happen in the world, that God has the power to stop any evil from unfolding in the world, which would lead you to think, well, then we don't need to do anything. Either God wants climate change to happen as some kind of punishment of humanity, like the new Noah, or God will stop it before it goes too far. So people's theological mindset around God's action in the world can have very strong implications for whether or not they worry about climate change and think we need to act on it. Yeah. The other thing is that the Pope criticises anthropocentrism, technological anthropocentrism, very strongly and very well, but he does it from a basis of completely theological anthropocentrism, like accepting maybe evolution on the one hand, but also saying that...
Well, let's explain that for the listener. In anthropocentrism, this is the idea that the human person is at the centre of everything, the centre of the argument. That's what it means.
The centre is the story of God and life, that's right. Yeah, so the Catholic Church, on the one hand, accepts evolution, but also says, but we know that there's a leap between humans and other species that can't possibly be breached apart from the fact that God put us off
as
a human. So that's a truth. That would be an example of one of Jonathan's saying there are truth claims in Christianity that now can be examined scientifically, and we see that actually we're on a continuum between humans and the rest of creation, and a very recent arrival in the story, and Christianity really hasn't grappled with that at all well. But in terms of climate change, I think the big one for Christians is whether we believe that God is in control of the world and won't let bad things happen, or whether we're called to action as God's hands and feet.
To be responsible. Now, Jonathan Meddings, I'm presuming you're finding some encouragement there, because there's a clear admission that the Christians are up to saying that God is in charge. There you go.
Yes, it's very encouraging. You know, there was a 2013 study in the US that found a belief in the second coming reduces the probability of strongly agreeing the government should take action on climate change by 12%, whilst also increasing the probability of strongly disagreeing the government should take action on climate change by 10%. So hopefully the Pope coming out now and saying we do need to act on climate change will help change those numbers.
So the Rational Society is giving a clap there to the Pope on this one, it sounds like.
Maybe a thumbs up. I don't know if I'm going to applaud just yet.
Rana Dajani, can I bring you in there? Because I'm interested to know if there's an interface between Islam, the Quran, and climate change and care for the climate. Is that something that's entering Muslim dialogue?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because part of the message of Islam is that human beings are responsible to take care of the earth, and take care of the earth, meaning biological and non-biological, that we are trustees on this earth. And part of that is taking care of the water, the air, and there are many verses that encourage this type of responsibility. So, and this has nothing to do with God interfering or not interfering. This is our role, our responsibility, to be responsible for our actions and to think of the generations to come. So supporting climate change is very big. And as you mentioned, in Turkey, it was a big thing that happened a few days ago.
Mm. Rana Dajani, I want to go on to a local issue, which is same-sex marriage. So I will say goodbye at this point, because I know it's not big in Jordan at the moment, but I want to thank you very much for being part of our program.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Great to hear from you. And that's where I'd like to go. John Carmody, can I bring you in here? Because you said something to me which is very interesting when we were preparing for this. You're a medical man, of course, and a man of science, but you said that you sort of lapsed when you were younger, and then you're having a conversation with your wife who persuaded you that religion had something to offer. Now, do you mind explaining what that was about?
Well, it was more than religion. Some people say I haven't grown out of my crass, bombastic era, but I can remember when I was a younger scientist and saying, I don't believe in, a bit like St. Thomas, I suppose, I don't believe that in anything that I can't see or feel or touch or, more to the point, measure. If you can't measure something, then you don't know much about it. And she simply said, but you're obsessed by music, you love art, you love literature, you're obsessed by beauty, you've got a loving family, how do you measure beauty and love? And I suddenly realised, and this is, I suppose, part of my deeper thinking about the nature of science and religion and all these interacting but distinct, they are different magisteria as far as I'm concerned, and I don't care what Jonathan says,
because he's, because he's the wrong. Arrogance of religious belief,
it's not an arrogance of religious belief at all. It's the knowledge of a scientist, Jonathan, someone who spent his whole life doing it, and I know they're very...
Well, I'm a scientist also.
You are. Then they're very different things. And to pretend, it's like saying you read literature for scientific truth, or you do science for the kind of aesthetic beauty that you find in art. They're just different things. And that's what you're getting at, Noel, that I suddenly realised that there is...
A different type of discourse, as it were.
Absolutely different type of discourse. And different humans are complex, and you need all sorts of discourses and all sorts of language and all sorts of means of study if you're going to understand not just the world, but the way we live in that world, the way we interact with one another as members of that world, or the whole of the biosphere, for that matter.
Well, Jonathan Meddings, can I bring you back there? Because we just talked about love, beauty, we talked about these things. And, of course, the last thing I'd like to talk about, which I think is relevant to the idea of religion and science, there are many things, but this is a thing that's been big in the news, is, of course, the same-sex marriage issue and marriage equality, because a lot of this argument is based on the theory of what a human person is and what a human person is designed to be, isn't it?
I'm not sure what you mean by designed to be.
In the sense that if you read Genesis, male and female, he created them, and he created them biologically complementary, in a complementary manner, and therefore that's the only way things can go, really, because that's the intention in the design, if you know what I mean.
Well, sure, if you're going to be operating off the assumption that we're designed, I would disagree with that.
So you wouldn't accept a design at all. You'd see a human being which has evolved through evolutionary processes which are not directed, which have resulted in what we are.
You say not directed, you have to be careful. Mutation is random, but natural selection is not. So there is a sense of direction, but it's not designed.
And not aiming towards human beings, I think, is the other insight of evolution.
Yes.
We happen to be here, but it could have gone a whole lot of different ways if it was rewound and run again.
Well, it did for so many others. 99.9% of all species that have ever existed are now extinct.
Sure. Yep.
Not a very well-designed system if it is designed.
Michael Brown, can I bring
incredibly
you...
wasteful.
Michael Brown, capricious. You've got the big picture. Do you mind jumping in there on that one? Because human beings not being an object of evolution, of course, puts us to the side, as it were, doesn't it, in a much bigger scheme of things?
Yeah, we are... not necessarily, we're certainly not at the centre of things. That's sort of been the nature of the past several hundred years of astronomy, that the Earth was removed as the centre of the solar system, that the solar system wasn't the centre of the galaxy, and now the galaxy is no more the centre of the universe than any other galaxy. And one of the exciting things that could happen in astronomy in the next couple of decades is evidence for life beyond the Earth, and that will very much change how we view ourselves in the universe, and probably how it'll change some aspects of how religions view our place in the universe as well.
Well, Jason, John, can I bring you in again? Sorry to give you the hard question.
Sure.
But you're in a church which, of course, has been engaged in long dialogue about the same-sex issue.
Yeah.
And if we're going to talk relative as we've just been talking, how do you think about those issues? Because it's been very hot for the last 2 weeks. What do you do with your congregation? How do you stand within your church? And how do you talk about it?
Okay, well, a couple of things. I mean, coming initially, my own perspective is that Genesis, gives us a fixed order of creation and male and female and so on. But evolution shows us that's just rubbish. There was first reproduction wasn't sexual at all, and then sexual reproduction began, and then eventually we got genders, and many creatures have more than one. So sexual reproduction is this fluid thing, and humans are a moment in time, but in no way designed, I don't think, as male and female. But here we are, male and female. When we look in the Hebrew
script, and intersex, they're often forgotten.
Oh, of course, yeah, intersex, of course, yeah.
And when we look in the Hebrew scriptures, we see that, of course, there was polygamy and all kinds of different ways of having sexual relationships, which is often...
Sorry, I've lost you. Beg your pardon.
We appear to have lost Jason, but I can jump in and talk about same-sex marriage. Then.
Yes, jump in, go on.
Well, I mean, speaking as a gay man, I do find it embarrassing that we don't have it in this day and age. It is really a matter of equality. Why should religious people have a privileged right to what is a civil institution?
Well, this has been part of what the debate has been about, of course.
Yes, but we've been having this debate for well over 10 years. I think the debate is well and truly over.
Well, not a parliamentary.
Don't tell the parliamentary
yes,
people.
Yes, don't tell
that.
The parliament.
Maybe you think it ought to be, but nobody could say that in Australia who's been reading the newspapers of late. And in any case, I don't think you should say that marriage is for religious people, because the vast majority of religions contracted in Australia, and all of them in Europe, are civil contracts. So
I'm sorry, I didn't say that marriage was only for religious people. I said just the opposite.
No, that's not what you said, actually, if you listen to what you had to say.
I said that marriage is a civil institution. Those were my words.
No, you didn't. You said it's not just for the religious people can't. Well, I can't
determine it. It was about
determining it, absolutely.
Which is what is, in a sense, what's happening, because religious leaders are standing very hard on this. The Catholic bishops have written the Don't Mess With Marriage document saying, you know, we don't want this to happen. Other religious leaders have spoken out. So in that sense, Jonathan's quite right that they have stood in that way. But what I'm interested in here is the science and religion connection in the idea of design or evolution, and whether you can make an argument based only from a religious or also from an evolutionary position. Perhaps we should hear from a scientist again, Dr. John Carmody. You've done neuroscience, for example.
Oh, yes. It's a social issue. There's no question that reproduction of one sort or another has gone on for eons, and in higher orders, it's sexual reproduction. And that's going to happen without any intervention of religions or legislatures. For all sorts of social reasons, the institution of marriage was set up for family stability, for dynastic stability, for financial
stability,
child stability, etc., etc. The church has got into it very late in the piece, but have become very possessive while doing so, while at the same time putting their priesthood as ones that can't marry. So there's a major intellectual...
Unless they're Maronite Catholics, of course, they're allowed to marry. And Ukrainian Catholics, they're allowed to marry.
Yes, but an Orthodox ones too, but yeah, they can't be bishops. They can't get the glittering prize.
Yes, that's true.
So we're talking about something which is fundamentally... not essential for reproduction, but is essential for certain, important for certain social values, and secular societies have looked after that for a very long period of time. So it is a social contract that we're talking about, in which the churches have an increasingly peripheral involvement, because the vast 70% of the population on polls are telling us that they're in favour of it. That means 30% are against it or hesitant about it, and the number of people practicing their religions is less than 20% or thereabouts. So the statistics are very murky, and it's ultimately the churches are no wiser about this than anybody else.
We've got only 1 minute to go. Jason, John, I'm so sorry I cut you off. It was an accident. You get to have a word there, though, because you were in the middle of saying something.
Yeah, so very quickly, I don't think we'll ever be able to have a meaningful discussion about sexuality and marriage without understanding evolution. So that's the first thing the church needs to get its head around. Mm-hmm. The second is that it's ironic that the church is so adamant about this, when in my reading of Scripture, Jesus and Paul were very ambivalent about marriage, completely
Got
ambivalent 10 about
seconds.
Marriage, and about biological families. We were meant to be revolutionising the world, not stabilising society.
I've got to cut you off and thank you all. To Dr.
Go
Jason
the
John
revolution.
From the Uniting Church, Jonathan Mennings from the Board Member of the Rational Society of Australia, Michael Brown, the Associate Professor in Astronomy at Monash University, and Dr. John Carmody, who's a long-term medical scientist. I want to thank you all for having a go at the universal questions.
Thanks very much, Noel.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.